Good afternoon. So, last time we finished up talking about vector instructions, mentioned some sort of details about real world other vector implementations other than ones we're using in SIMD Lab and the smooth assignment. So mentioned that, well, we have real problems dealing with like conditionals and loops, or with non-contiguous values. And there are things where hardware can provide extra support to help with that. We're not going to have time to go in detail about that in the class, but I want you to know that that's a thing, that there are options where hardware can add features that make these more practical to vectorize. And these are not always things that every processor has chosen to do when they've implemented vector instructions, but if you're doing something where kind of the whole point of some processor is vector instructions, like a GPU, you're going to have those sorts of features. Also mentioned that there are other ways of programming vector instructions, most notably GPU programming often kind of looks like multi-threaded programming, the same sort of thing you do to program multiple cores, even though that's going to be implemented in terms of something more like vector instructions. GPUs just have the compiler do that sort of work. Then we talk sort of more generally about optimization. And one of the things that comes up when you're optimizing programs in the real world is that you're going to say, oh, this is too slow. And you're going to say, OK, so let's start optimizing it. And an extremely common mistake programmers make is that they assume that when the program's slow, that they know, well, of course, all its work is going to be in this part of the program. And a lot of the time, they're wrong. And sometimes they just don't know. And for either case, what you should do is you should run one of these tools known as a profiler, which, you know, when you're running your program, it figures out where are you spending the time, possibly by just stopping the program periodically and saying, what's running right now? And this allows you to optimize things that actually matter and not waste your time trying to speed something up that, you know, isn't actually the reason why it seems slow. So then we moved on to talking a bit about exceptions and sort of generally hardware support to help operating systems be written. And we started with talking about sort of the biggest thing that an operating system does, which is provides this abstraction we know as a process. And a process gives each program this sort of illusion that it has a dedicated machine, that when you write programs, we write it as if I'm going to be the only one running on the processor. That means I'm going to have my own core with its own registers and its own program counter. And it doesn't matter that there are other programs. I'm not going to notice them. I'm just going to write it as if I'm the only one using the system. And this is even going to be true if we have other programs that are sharing the same core. And the same thing is true in terms of memory. I'm going to have my own values at every single address. If I choose a random memory address, I'm not going to accidentally be accessing something that another program had. As far as I'm concerned, everything in memory is for me. And this illusion collectively is known as a process. The two pieces of it, the part where we seem like we have our own core is called a thread, and the part where we seem like we have our own memory is called an address space. And these are things that an operating system is going to provide to programs, but we're going to need some help from the hardware. And to provide the illusion of threads, or dedicated cores that are threads, we're going to typically, in the operating system, use this idea called time multiplexing, that we're going to have a single core, we're going to share by dividing up time between programs, periodically switching from one to the other. And to implement that, we're going to do this thing called a context switch. So we're going to have something called a context, which is the information that's visible about what a program running on a core. So that's its registers, its condition codes, sort of all the state of the program that determines what instructions the program would run do. And we're going to save that somewhere when we switch away from a program and restore it when we switch back. And the operating system can store that information in its own memory while other programs are running. And by doing this switching pretty rapidly, we can kind of create the illusion that multiple programs are running at the same time on one core, even though that's not really what's happening. Really, they're sharing the core with some small amount of time in between. So one of the things we needed to implement that idea is that, well, if our programs are written assuming they have the CPU to themselves, then they're not going to stop at any point in time and make the OS run to switch to another program. So we need some way of writing the OS, even though the code that the program is running, that is sort of actually what the program counter points to right now, is not going to say to do that. And this mechanism is something we called exceptions. And these hardware exceptions, I should emphasize, are not the exceptions you see in C++, Java, Python. There's a relationship, yes. These are both things that happen to be the way we handle sort of error conditions, but hardware exceptions otherwise are unrelated. They're handled differently. They do more things and different things than our programming language idea of exceptions. And for hardware exceptions, there are lots of things that can cause them. So I mentioned one of them is that error events, like sort of out of bounds accesses, illegal instructions. So these are things where a program does something that doesn't make sense. We have other causes that are from things the program does. These we call synchronous exceptions. And a notable one of those, which we'll talk more about today, are system calls, where the program makes a deliberate exception to ask the OS to do something. And there are also these asynchronous causes, where it's not related at all to the code in the program that's running, just something external to the program happened, such as a timer going off, or some I/O happening, like something comes in from the network, I press a key on the keyboard. These are also things that trigger exceptions, and when this gets triggered, the OS runs. And we mentioned how that happens. So our model for exceptions is that at boot, the OS makes this big table of the functions it has to handle each possible type of exception, and it sets a register, special register on the processor, to point to that. And then when the processor gets an exception, it does a lookup in that table and jumps to the location specified in the appropriate entry in the table, and we'll have a separate entry for each kind of exception. What the kinds are will vary between processors, but like we might have one entry for divide by zero, one entry for illegal instruction, one entry for like input from the keyboard, and so on. So questions about these things I covered last time? Before we move on. Okay, so when we were finishing up last time, I mentioned this idea that it seems like, you know, I could defeat this notion of the OS, like, gets to, you know, switch between programs by just, you know, setting my own exception handler, that I can just set a new exception table because there's an instruction the OS runs to do that. Why can't I run that instruction? And when I try to do this, you know, I can carefully construct my exception table. I can use the instruction to set it as the current exception table. And when I try this, I get this message, segmentation fault. And what that means is that the processor saw me trying to do this and decided that it's going to not do that, and instead it's going to tell the OS, hey, this program tried to set a new exception table. What do you want to do about that? The OS decided, I'll crash the program and tell the shell that it can print segmentation fault. And this idea is known as a privilege instruction, that we're going to set aside a bunch of instructions as privileged, meaning that not just any program is going to be allowed to do that. And this is kind of a necessary thing if we want to share the machine between multiple users. So like our lab servers, we don't want it to be the case that what I do logging into the server is going to interfere with your programs. In particular, we don't want, even if I'm not malicious, we don't want, if like I like write a buggy program, that shouldn't make it so that your data gets messed up. And we also don't want it to be the case if I'm malicious that it gets your data messed up. So there's a whole bunch of operations we want to make sure don't happen when programs aren't supposed to do it, like setting an exception table, setting a new address space, because that would sort of defeat the idea of giving programs separate memory if I can just change what my memory points to. Talking to I/O devices. So the operating system is always going to be responsible for deciding who gets to send what to what I/O device. So if I press a key on the keyboard, we want that to go to the operating system, generally, so the operating system can figure out who should I send this to. We're usually, you know, there might be some rare exceptions, but we're usually not going to have that go directly to the program. We're usually going to have that go through the operating system, and the operating system is going to keep track of what program do I want to access this keyboard, or this display, or this part of the hard drive, and so on. So to implement this idea that some of these instructions are going to be reserved for the OS, the processor is going to have two modes it can run in. There's one mode we'll call kernel mode, where the privilege instructions are going to do their normal thing that we expect them to do, like setting exception tables, changing the address space, sending a message to an I/O device, and so on. And there's going to be another mode we'll call user mode, where rather than doing that, the privilege instructions just cause an exception. So to implement this, the processor needs to keep some extra information. It needs to keep track of which mode it's in. So a way it might do this is it might have a 1-bit register, your RB in kernel mode, and all those instructions are going to read that register before they do anything. If that register is 0, they're not going to do the intended operation, they're just going to cause an exception. Now, something we need to make kernel mode useful is that it can't be the case that when I start running my program, I'm stuck in user mode forever, because then we can't ever write anything to the screen. That's a privileged instruction. It's talking to an I/O device. We can't change an address space to switch to another program. That's a privileged instruction. So we need some way of being able to switch back to kernel mode after we're in user mode. But we can't just let programs do that voluntarily. Otherwise, we go back to this code. You know, there would be some way for me to switch to kernel mode, and I could still set an exception table, defeating the whole point of this privileged instruction thing. So we want to still be able to go back into kernel mode, but only let OS code run. And the primary mechanism we'll use to do this is that we'll have exceptions, we'll enter kernel mode. So all those exception handlers that are pointed to by the exception table will always end up running in kernel mode when the processor has an exception. And we'll have this return from exception instruction. And I mentioned earlier that, it might not seem yet like we need one, but we're going to have a special instruction. And one of the things that instruction is going to do is it's going to leave kernel mode if the exception entered kernel mode. And that's something we need a special instruction for, because otherwise it wouldn't be obvious how we set back this "are we in kernel mode" bit. And this also tells us why we wanted this idea of a system call. So I said that we'd use an exception that was deliberately triggered to ask the OS to do something. And originally that seemed like maybe just a convenience thing. But with this idea of kernel mode, it's more than that, because we often want the OS to do something that it can't do in user mode. So even if we could just call a function that's part of the OS, that's not going to be enough. Because that function's, if it's a normal function call, it's going to run in user mode. So to actually have the OS do things on our behalf in kernel mode, we're going to have to trigger an exception deliberately in order to have that code that's part of the OS run in kernel mode. Okay, so questions about kernel mode and switching to kernel mode? So with this introduction of kernel mode, we've gotten rid of this strategy for kind of defeating the OS's idea of it's going to share the processor no matter what you do. But it seems like maybe we have a workaround. There's a question of maybe we can edit the exception table. So the exception table's in memory, and we can write to memory. So could we edit it? And you might say, well, you told me about address translation earlier. So you might say, okay, so it's just not going to be the case that we have an address that maps to that. And that works on some processors, but often the exception handlers, including the exception table, are going to use the same translation map that everything else uses. So if you want your exception table to work, it has to be in that mapping. You know, the processor is going to run all the code using the current address space mapping, including exception handlers. So how do we deal with that? And, well, we're going to have a way to do that. And if you looked at our diagrams of process memory earlier, you may have noticed this sort of dash space I labeled used by OS. So it's dashed meaning that it's inaccessible, but it's used. It's used by the OS somehow. And typically, most OSs are going to put things like exception handlers and other OS data structures in this part of that memory. And this is going to be something that's part of that mapping. But we don't want it to be the case that a program can just edit the exception handler up there or other information that might be part of that memory. So we're going to have an extra feature in our mappings. So we're going to be able to specify a mapping that says, this address maps to here, but it should only work in kernel mode. If it's in user mode, it should just trigger an exception. And typically, this is how we're going to have our exception table work. Our exception table is going to be one of these kernel mode only mappings. That's not going to be a problem when an exception handler runs, because the exception handler is going to run in kernel mode. But that means that our normal program is not going to be able to interfere with the exception handler or its data structures, so long as we place them in one of these kernel mode only areas. Some questions about these kernel only mappings? Okay. And something to note is that sort of I drew these regions as sort of the same part of memory. And in this example here, I indicated that this OS data would be the same for both processes. So this is typically how OSs are implemented. They don't have to do that. But very commonly, they'll just, in every single process, they'll make part of the address space go to the OS's data structure in the same place to the same real addresses. This is not the only way you can implement an OS, but it's a very common thing to do. So when we have these events where a process tries to either run instructions that are privileged or access memory that is marked kernel mode only in that mapping, this triggers what we call a protection fault. And that's where we have, that's a type of exception, where the OS gets control and decides what to do. And our most common thing we've seen the OS do is crashing the program. It doesn't have to do that. We'll talk probably in a week or two about some other real possibilities, but one of the more obvious ones that's not crashing the program is that maybe we run the debugger and say, hey, your program did this thing that looks weird. What do you want to, take a look at it? So there are other options. The OS just gets to run whatever code it wants to do that. So we talked about privileged operations. So let's make sure we understood. So which of these things, if we try to do them in user mode, shouldn't work? Should require some sort of exception to happen or some sort of, involvement of the OS in kernel mode. who'd like some more time? Okay, so who thinks A is something that will fail and cause an exception? Okay, B? Okay, C? And D? Okay, so we have consensus that B is going to cause an exception. So if we want to allocate a program more memory, which in a way that requires changing the address space, we're going to have the OS get involved somehow and give us permission to do that by doing it on our behalf, generally. So A, we had some mix on. So if we're running instructions that actually communicate with the hard disk device, this is generally something that user mode code is not going to be allowed to do. We're going to have to ask the OS to do this on our behalf. So yes, we can write a normal program that reads files. How are those files going to be read? We're going to have to ask the OS for help in that. And if you think about the case of a shared machine like the portal machines, this should make a lot of sense because you shouldn't be able to read other people's files. How do we make that happen? We make sure the OS gets involved and decides what files you're allowed to read. It doesn't just let you access the hard disk directly, even though multiple people's files are on that disk. So generally, the OS is going to configure things such that, accessing the hard drive, that's going to trigger an exception if the program does it directly. If you want it to be done, you're going to have to ask the OS to do that for you. Okay, we have pretty good consensus that returning from a standard library function doesn't require any sort of exception to happen. So we had less agreement about incrementing the stack pointer. So for incrementing stack pointer, the temptation to say is, wait a moment, doesn't moving the stack pointer allocate and deallocate stack space? And that's a reasonable thing to think about. Generally, what will happen is that the OS will typically pre-allocate the stack space. But we'll learn that sometimes the stack space is allocated and deallocated dynamically. But the mechanism for doing that is not going to happen when you increment the stack pointer, because that's just setting a register. And you can set RSP the same way you can set RAX. The OS is not going to be involved in that. So if there is sort of dynamic allocation or deallocation of the stack space, it's going to happen at some other point in time, such as when you try to access memory that's not mapped yet, which we'll talk about a bit in a week or two. Yes? For A, the question is, why is there a problem? So the question is, what is the privileged operation? Is it accessing memory that's outside of the address space, or is it something else? Typically, it's the instructions, the special instructions that communicate with the specific I/O device would be privileged.
Okay, so when I read A, what I thought he was saying was looking at, for instance, the part of our address space that goes to the OS, is like the OS part of the address space that we had in our previous diagram,
Yeah.
And that reading that was allowed and writing to it was not. Is this talking about a different kind of reading data?
So this is reading data on disk by communicating with the hard disk device. Mm-hmm. So the problem is that the OS is generally not going to allow us to communicate directly with the device, because a device like a hard disk especially needs to be shared in a controlled manner. And the OS needs to be responsible for making those decisions, so we're not going to allow normal programs to do that.
Okay.
So if we want to give a program direct access to a device, so first of all, that typically doesn't happen on an OS, but sometimes it does. But if we're going to give one program dedicated access to a device, we can't really easily share that device with other programs without a lot of extra work. And sharing that device is very important for the hard drive. Kind of not very useful if it's not shared between multiple programs. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Other questions? Okay, so this reveals that there's a bunch of what I'll call kernel services, things we need to be done in kernel mode on our program's behalf. Allocating memory. If you call malloc, sometimes it needs to give your program more address space, change that mapping. It's going to have to ask the OS for help doing that. If you're reading and writing a file, you're going to have to ask the OS for help in doing that. If you're reading from the keyboard, you're going to have to ask the OS for help. All these things need privileged instructions, so there's no way we as a normal program are going to be able to implement it without asking the OS to do something on our behalf to run code in kernel mode. And the way we're going to do that is by deliberately triggering an exception. That deliberate exception will go into kernel mode. And the OS will have written code for us that will do these things on our behalf in a way that the OS decided was OK. So it will let us read from files, but only files that we're supposed to be able to access. It will let us allocate memory, but not in a way that's going to interfere with other programs' memory, and so on. So I'm going to talk specifically about how system calls work on 64-bit x86 Linux. And the main thing that you use for system calls there is this instruction called syscall, which is a trap, meaning it's a deliberately triggered exception. The only thing the syscall instruction does is cause an exception to happen. And that's why it exists. And this is the hardware support that's provided for doing these system calls. It's just this instruction. And Linux chose a calling convention for its system calls. So just like on x86, the hardware provides this call instruction, but doesn't tell you how you pass arguments, what registers you use, and so on. Same thing is true for system calls. The hardware provides you this trapping instruction, and that's it. You, as the OS author, decide all the other things of how you figure out what operation's being requested, what the arguments are, how you tell whether it's successful or not. And Linux has chosen a calling convention for its system calls that looks a lot like a function call. The biggest difference is that we need to specify what thing are you asking me to do. Are you asking me to read from a file, to write to the terminal, to allocate more memory, and so on. And we're going to indicate that information using the register REX, which is going to contain a system call number. And Linux just assigned a bunch of system call numbers to different operations. We can't do the sort of thing we did with call instructions and call a particular function because, well, all we have is an instruction that triggers a trap. There's no extra information part of the instruction. We don't know where any of the functions are in the OS if we're writing a normal program. So we have to just specify this number to indicate which operation do I mean, and just Linux made a table to decide these are the things I'll let you request. And Linux needs to pass arguments to these, so like if I'm writing something to a terminal, what am I writing? And Linux decided that they'll pass arguments in basically the same way we pass arguments to normal functions, using 6 argument registers. We also need to return results, like did I successfully write that? Or read something, or allocate memory. And Linux decided we'd put that information in REX, that would be our return value, and on error, by convention, we'll just return a negative number. It'll tell us what went wrong. So this is convention they chose is almost the same as a normal function call, except we have a different way of specifying what operation we're doing. And we have to use this syscall instruction in order to make sure that happens in the OS code, not just some normal function. So we know what the convention is. Let's look at some code that uses system calls. So this is a Hello World program that can run without the standard library on Linux. So normally you like call printf, and printf is going to call some system calls. This program doesn't require any standard library. And one of the consequences of that is that how it exits is different. So normally, when we write a program in C, we write main. And we return from main, and our program terminates. The way that's implemented is that the standard library calls main. And when main returns, the standard library makes a system call to exit the current program. And we need a system call to do that because exiting the current program is something that the OS needs to handle, because we want to get rid of the memory for the current program and switch to another one. That's something that requires kernel mode. We can't figure out what the other programs are. We don't have access to that information in user mode. We can't change the address space to the other program we want to run. We can't in user mode. We need the OS's help. So exiting is one of these things that is a system call that we're going to do. And in this program, we have two system calls. We first have this first system call is to write hello world to the screen, or to, well, standard out. So we specify the system call number for write, which happens to be 1. We specify where we want to write to, and 1 happens to correspond to standard out. We provide our string as a pointer and the length of the string, and we make that system call. This is writing hello world. And then we need to exit, so I specify my operation is exit, which is number 60. And I specify an argument of 0. So this argument is the same as the return value for main, usually return 0, to indicate that everything went OK. That's what that 0 is there. So questions about my hello world program that doesn't use the standard library? OK. So this is the user mode program side of it. And to make this work, there's going to be a exception handler for the type of exception caused by system calls. And that's going to be pointed to by the exception table. And sort of what it notionally might look like is that it's going to do our standard boilerplate for exception handlers. We're going to save all the registers, then restore them later. But sort of its main thing it's going to do is it's going to have a table of handlers for each of the kinds of system calls. So we saw 1 was write, 60 was exit. So we'll have a big table in the OS code of the actual thing that implements read, write, exit, and so on. And we'll just typically do a table lookup based on RAX into that. Questions on this sort of notional idea of what sort of a normal system call handler would look like, given something like the Linux way of calling system calls. Okay, so that's our system call handler, and Linux provides a lot of system calls. So there's system calls for allocating memory. There's system calls for creating a new process. We can't do that ourselves. We can't make a new address space, assign new memory. System calls for running a different program, or we have it load a new program from disk. Can't, just do that ourselves typically. System calls for exiting a process and for accessing files, for opening, reading, and writing files. And a whole bunch of others. If you actually look at the list in Linux, there's like a couple hundred system calls. My understanding is Windows is like 1,000-ish. So there's lots of system calls. So we saw how to write system calls in assembly. And some of you who've programmed stuff for Linux or other Unix likes might be a little confused here, because often you're told that, you can call the write function, and that's a system call, or the underscore exit function, and that's a system call, or the memmap function, and that's a system call. But that's just a normal function call. So what's happening there? So there are usually C functions in the standard library that, for on Unix-like systems, that are what I call system call wrappers. These are C functions whose only purpose is to call a particular system call. And you notice that the Linux calling convention for system calls was very similar to normal function calls. So basically, all these functions do is set RAX to the right system call number and make a syscall instruction. And they exist because we can't actually write the system call instruction in C, right? That's not what a function call does. So just for the convenience of being able to access these system calls from C, we'll have these wrapper functions, which, it's not going to be like printf, where we make a printf call, and it's extremely complicated exactly what system calls it will make. It might need to allocate memory. It might write things in multiple chunks. But we'll have a system call wrapper for write where all it does is set the arrayX to indicate the system call number for write 1 and make a syscall instruction. So really simple, just so we can use it from C without writing assembly. So questions on system call wrappers? So that have a bunch of operations here. So which of these are going to require exceptions to happen? So won't work unless there's some sort of exception involved. Which of these would require context switches to happen? Okay, who'd like some more time? Okay, so who thinks, let's start with just requiring exceptions. We'll talk about context switches later. Who thinks A requires an exception? Okay, B. Okay, C. Okay, D. Okay, E. F. Okay, so let's start with A. So we had very good consensus that B requires an exception. So assuming we aren't letting programs access the disk directly because we have like file permissions and it's multiple programs need to share the disk in a controlled way, you know, that's going to require an exception. The OS is going to have to intermediate, you know, how we share the disk between multiple programs. A program going to sleep letting another program run, that's going to require an exception. We have to, you know, run another program. We have to switch to another address space. We can't do that ourselves. Without the OS getting involved, we need an exception to occur to make that happen. We had a little less consensus on a program exiting. So that will require an exception because we want the OS to do something else. So we have to ask the OS to do something. And that something else is probably going to involve changing to a different address space. And with the program exiting, we want to deallocate memory. So the OS is going to need to be involved to do that. So I should write exceptions. And then we had returning from one function to another. We had pretty good consensus that it did not require exceptions, and it shouldn't. That's just reading a value from the stack and jumping. You know, as long as it's all valid memory, which presumably if it's successful, it is, no problem. And the same with popping a value from the stack. That's just changing what the stack pointer is and reading a value. As long as all that memory is valid, there's no reason for an exception to happen. And even though we're conceptually deallocating memory, if the OS is going to do that, it's going to have to do that some other way because it's not going to be run automatically by the pop operation. Okay, so then we had a less agreement about a program runs a function in the standard library. And probably what you're thinking is that there are a lot of functions in the standard library which cause exceptions. So like if we print something, that's going to getting it to the screen is going to involve an exception. If we read keyboard input, that's going to involve an exception. But there are also a lot of standard library functions which don't. So like, say, stringlen, or sprintf, or pow. There's a whole lot of functions which don't require exceptions. And some functions which only sometimes require exceptions, like malloc. Often malloc allocates memory, but typically the way it works is it gets a big chunk of memory and then subdivides that. So if it's only getting a new subdivision of something it already allocated, probably not going to use a system call. No exceptions required. So this could use an exception. It could use an exception sometimes, but generally not required. And there's many standard library calls you make which should never require an exception. So questions about that answer? Okay, so let's talk about context switches. So which of these require context switches? Who thinks A, B, C, okay, D, E, and F? Okay, so we have pretty good consensus for context switches that C and D should require one. So C requires one because, well, we're switching from program A to program B, and since having program A go to sleep, let program B run, presumably it's running on the same core. Program exiting, we're going to generally have a context switch because as long as there's something else to run, we should run it now. That means a context switch to start running that. And we certainly can't keep running the same thing. There's nothing to run. I think there was a little disagreement about E. So everything else I say shouldn't use a context switch. Like I could imagine if writing a file to a disk takes a while, maybe we'd switch away from the program while doing that, but there's no requirement to do that. And often it won't happen. So returning from one function to another. So you might say this kind of looks like a context switch because we're like saving and restoring registers, and I agree there's a relationship there. When we say a context switch, we mean saving sort of all the registers somehow. So if we're just like saving a few registers like we do for a function call, that's not a context switch. And a context switch generally means not only are we saving registers, we're restoring some registers from elsewhere. And function calls or returns You know, typically we don't have that in both ends. We aren't, like when we return from a function, we don't save the registers. And when we, you know, call a function, we don't restore some old version of registers, we just set them anew. And a context switch, you know, necessarily involves we're restoring some existing context and saving a context to restore later. You know, and that doesn't, we don't have both sides of that in a function call. So questions about context switches and these operations? Yes?
In general, is an exception necessary for a context switch?
The question is an exception necessary for a context switch? So this depends on your exact definition of context switch. A context switch between two processes, absolutely, because we need to change the outer space. We can switch between two threads without an exception, because everything we do for doing that doesn't actually require a privileged operation. On most current systems, you won't see that happening, but it has historically been a common thing.
You won't see the switching between threads?
So in most current systems, switching between threads will happen with an exception in the OS. That is the most common implementation of threads these days. But historically, that has not always been true, and you will find some exceptions here and there. Other questions? Okay. So, I talked a bunch about exceptions, and I want to give a note on terminology. So you may have noticed that I had this figure here with all these terms our textbook uses, including some I didn't really go over, like aborts, which are an exception that happens when the hardware is broken, like when memory no longer stores values consistently, and you know, interrupts, traps, faults, and I spent very little time actually like using these terms and telling you, having you memorize them, and the main reason why is that, you know, I've been trying to be consistent with our textbook's terminology, but the world is not consistent about what exceptions are called. So if you pick up a processor manual, if you pick up the x86 manual from Intel, they'll call everything interrupts. Our textbook calls interrupts only for the externally triggered things. If you pick up some manuals, including, I think Intel's and maybe ARM's, you'll see the word exception used only to refer to what our textbook calls faults, to things that are triggered by the program doing something weird. Our textbook uses the term abort to refer to the hardware, something is wrong with the hardware, and asks the OS to like, deal with it. Some manuals will call that a hard fault instead. We use the term trap to refer to intentionally triggered exceptions. Some places will use the term trap to refer to faults, to exceptions triggered by the program doing something weird like a divide by zero. You'll see all sorts of variations on this terminology, and if you like are picking up a processor manual or some documentation about OS or something, and you want to figure out what they mean, you have to look for how they define these terms. This is unfortunate. And this is why I'm going to avoid quizzing you on sort of the categories of exceptions by name, because, well, it's not actually useful. You know, whenever you pick up a processor manual, you're going to have to check, because it's different pretty much every time. So terminology for exceptions is really bad and really inconsistent. There's some inconsistent terminology for kernel mode, but at least usually you can figure out what they mean. So sometimes they won't use the words kernel mode, they'll call it something like supervisor mode or privileged mode. Or ring zero is a common term. And related to that ring zero idea, some systems have multiple levels of privilege. So there might be like a privileged mode and a, you know, hypervisor, virtual machine monitor mode. Or there might be a privileged mode and a supervisor mode. And basically, what the difference between those multiple levels of privilege will be is that different sets of operations will work. Or with the ring terminology, ring zero will be the most privileged mode, and there'll be ring one, two, and three, you know, and you can do more things in ring 0 than ring 1, more things in ring 1 than ring 2, and so on. So you'll see variation terminology, but usually this is easier to figure out and less confusing. It's not like the exception terminology where they'll use the same term and it will mean something different. Here, like, they'll use a different term, but typically the meaning will be similar or the same. Yes?
Why would multiple levels of privilege be a good thing?
The question is, why would multiple levels of privilege be a good thing? So the classic modern example is for implementing virtual machines. It's really nice to have some sort of mode which normal OSs run in, and some sort of mode that virtual machine implementations run in. So that's sort of the most common modern example. Historically, people thought that we were going to like divide the OS into pieces and run some parts with more privilege than others. And a lot of systems were designed with this, including x86. I would say that, except for that sort of virtual machine versus OS distinction, and a related distinction between sort of system management code, is sort of code that is kind of below the OS related to sort of firmware stuff, except for those sorts of distinctions, I think this idea has mostly died. But it still exists in a lot of architectures, because it was at one point a common idea for how OSs should look. Yes?
Would the virtual machine just be kind of a subset like of the OS? So like when it thinks that it's in kernel mode, it's actually, you know, the real OS is user mode? And like.
Question is, shouldn't the virtual machine look like an OS? That is a common implementation of a virtual machine. And then there are sort of a set of implementations which are designed with extra hardware support. And some of them sort of involve something that looks like an extra privilege level, at least. Typically, when people have designed modern ways of implementing virtual machines, they've been more careful than we have in the past with making them nestable. So you can run a virtual machine monitor in a virtual machine, and they've sort of designed it with that in mind, which makes them different than how the typical user kernel mode stuff often works. Would that answer your question? But certainly, you don't actually need a separate privilege level to implement virtual machines. You can do it with just two. And with that, you can do it pretty efficiently with just two. You can do it inefficiently with just one, but that's more annoying. Other questions? Okay, so our last topic for today, and for probably most of the rest of the semester, is going to be virtual memory. So we talked about sort of our program's memory layout, and we mentioned that this was implemented with this mapping. Now there's going to be some mapping, and we're going to choose one of these during a context switch, and it's going to provide our programs with the illusion that they have their own memory. So first, we're going to talk about some terminology we're going to use for our scheme for implementing this mapping. We're going to call the addresses a program access, and this includes every single address the program uses. If it's calling a function, it's using one of the address that gets translated. If it's accessing something in memory with a move instruction, it uses one of these addresses that get translated. There's no exceptions. So every program address a process access is going to be what we call a virtual address. That's going to go through this translation, and it's going to get translated to a physical address. And our virtual and physical addresses can have different sizes, and commonly will. And they're going to be translated by this mapping, and we're going to talk specifically about sort of formats for doing this. We're going to start with a sort of simple version of the typical, what we'll see is a page table format, and we'll talk more about making that practical over the next few weeks. So as a prerequisite for making this mapping, I'm going to use an example of a program with a very small virtual address space. It has 10 bits for its virtual addresses. So this is its very small memory, and I've divided it up into equally sized pieces, and I've assigned purposes for those pieces just as an illustration. And these are equally sized pieces I'm going to call pages. And I'm going to number them starting with 0. And I've chosen these pages very deliberately to have a size that's a power of 2. In this case, they are 2 to the 8 bytes. And just like with caches, where having sizes powers of 2s was really convenient because it made it easy to like look up things in the address, that's going to be true here. So because I chose a power of 2 for the size of each of these pages, I can look at the upper bits of the address to get that page number I assigned earlier. So I can easily go from an address to which page number it's a part of. And that's going to be really convenient because we don't want to like do any modulus operations and divide operations all the time. So I'm going to call those upper bits of the address the page number. Now, the rest of the address, I'm going to give the name page offset. This is where in the page we are. So 0 is the bottom of the page. All 1s is the, well, what we call the top of the page, the last address in the page, and everything else ranges in between. And this is might remind you of the same sort of idea we have with like parts of a cache block. You know, kind of the same concept. Now, the reason I'm going to divide up my program's memory like this is I'm going to use this to make my mapping more practical. And I'm going to make my mapping by saying I have my program's memory divided up this way, and I divide up my physical addresses into chunks of the same size. So in this example, my physical addresses have one extra bit, so I have twice as many of them as I have virtual addresses. And like my virtual addresses, I can assign page numbers to each of these chunks. And like with my virtual addresses, because I chose a power of 2 page size, I can just look at the bits in the address to read out those numbers. And the way I'm going to set up my mapping, the way the OS is going to specify the mapping, is that I'm going to draw a line from each chunk of virtual addresses I want to use to a chunk of physical addresses. Now, we can't actually give the processor a drawing like this to specify our mapping, so we're going to have to specify this in a more numerical way, and that's going to be a table. So we're going to specify this table where I, for each virtual page number, I have an entry that gives me a physical page number. And we're going to call this a page table. And this is how we're going to specify that mapping that from virtual addresses to physical addresses. So questions about what I've done so far? Okay, so we need to actually represent this in a way the processor can use, and that's going to look something like this. So one thing I've added here is I've added this valid bit. So like with caches, where we needed a valid bit to determine if there was nothing there, we have the same problem with page table entries, because not everything is mapped. So in this case, we had like one page which we didn't assign any addresses to. We need a valid bit to represent that. And for everything else, I give my physical page number. So I'm going to give this to the processor. This is going to be our mapping. And the processor is going to take an address from the CPU, and it's going to divide it up into its pieces. So it's going to have a page offset, which in this case is 8 bits because our pages were 2 to the 8 bytes. And we're going to have our page number, which in the address is what we'll call a virtual page number. And we're going to use that to look up a page table entry, which is an entry in the page table, one of those rows. We're going to get that out, similar to how we get it out of a cache. And we're going to check the valid bit, just like we would with a cache. And when it's invalid, we're not going to fetch it from memory. That's not a thing we can do. We're going to say, well, doesn't exist. I'm going to tell the OS that, hey, your program tried to access something that you didn't give me a mapping for. What do you want to do about it? I'm going to trigger an exception. If it's invalid, otherwise, I'm going to get my physical page number from there. and I'm going to put it at the beginning of my actual address and combine it with the page offset. So I'm going to go to the same part of the physical page as I started with the virtual page. And I'm going to send that on to my cache. And as noted here, this is going to happen before our data cache accesses and our instruction cache accesses. Because remember, it was all the addresses go through this mapping. Questions about this page table lookup process? Okay, so we have these page tables. I mentioned we have a virtual page numbers mapping to physical page numbers. These are terms we'll see used. So part of our context switch is going to be changing what page table is active. And this is going to be some extra privileged instructions to do that. And one of the problems we have is we need memory to do the switching. We need code in memory to do the switching, those exception handlers. And we mentioned earlier that our solution for that was going to be that part of the mapping could be kernel mode only. So how are we going to represent that? Well, we're going to have, code with page table entries pointing to it, because remember, before our instruction cache is this translation. If we want to run code, that translation is going to happen. We're going to have them mark kernel mode only. So how are we going to do that? We're going to add a column to our page table to indicate, is this kernel only or not, or alternately, if it's user allowed or not. In this example, I'm having it be kernel only, so one is kernel only, but we could represent it the opposite way. And it's the same lookup, but with this extra case where we might trigger an exception. And again, this is something we're going to do, in front of our data and in our instruction cache. Okay, some questions about this, about our simple page table lookup. Yes. So the question is, what's the similarities between caching and the page table lookup? So the biggest similarity is that we're doing similar things where we divide up our address into pieces to identify these sections of memory. In the case of pages, in the case of virtual memory, these are pages. In the case of caches, these are blocks.
Were they brought up in the same mythology?
So the question, is there a similarity in the history?
Yeah,
so yes. So we're going to talk about page tables as primarily a way to, provide this illusion that you own the whole memory. But one of the original purposes of this was implementing something like caching that the OS would do, where the OS would keep some data on disk instead of in memory and do it on demand. And we'll talk a bit about that later when we talk about what's called swapping. This is not how I teach virtual memory, even though it's how our textbook does it. It's not how I teach virtual memory because it's not the primary reason why virtual memory is used these days. Most OSs do support that idea of having data on disk that's kind of cached in memory, just like caches have data in cache that's kind of data from memory that's cached in the cache. But these days, the gaps in performance between disks and even SSDs and memory are much higher, so we do that a lot less. Which is why I'm not teaching that first. But that is, in fact, one of the design points behind the virtual memory scheme for dividing things up. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so for the sake of being synced with the other class, I'm going to stop here, and we'll pick up next time.